Chapter 23. The Munchkins. It was the job of William Webster's special assistants to clone themselves, to find similarly qualified and brilliant lawyers to replace them after their two-year stints were up. So in July 1986, Howard W. Gutman and William T. Hassler, then Webster's assistants at the FBI, began calling friends and contacts at prestigious law firms to find a good candidate to replace Gutman. Like the rest of Webster's assistants, both men had dream resumes. Gutman, for example, had graduated fifth in a class of 650 from Columbia University. He had graduated magna cum laude from Harvard Law School. He was a member of Phi Beta Kappa. He had been a law clerk to Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart. Later, he joined Williams and Connolly, eventually becoming a partner. The two assistants knew that Webster favored Ivy League graduates, particularly from Harvard or Yale. After extensive inquiries, Gutman called Nancy Dean McGregor, a 28-year-old lawyer who had graduated from Barnard College and Harvard Law School. Then at Steptoe & Johnson, McGregor was not only a very good lawyer, but extremely personable and attractive. With green eyes and brown hair, she had a direct approach that allowed her to say exactly what she wanted without creating bad feelings. She could be persistent in her questioning, yet tactful. When she decided to do something, she pursued it relentlessly and courageously. Yet she could be disarmingly charming. Born in Pittsburgh, McGregor was the daughter of Jack McGregor, a lawyer and former Pennsylvania state senator. Her father had treated her like a friend and colleague, keeping her informed on what he was doing and asking her advice. When McGregor was six, her family became worried when they couldn't find her one afternoon. It later turned out she had been canvassing the street, asking neighbors to vote for her father. McGregor had been working for Steptoe & Johnson for 2 years, handling white-collar criminal cases, when a partner in the firm said Gutman had approached him asking for recommendations on candidates for Webster's special assistant. Within Washington legal circles, the job was a plum. Not only did it give lawyers access to government at the highest levels, it was also a stepping stone to a partnership in one of the top law firms. "We decided you were the person we would like to propose for this," the partner said. Everything she had heard about the job made it sound very desirable. The chance to participate in the investigation rather than the defense of white-collar crimes, to see a lot of secret information very few people ever see, and to work for what she felt was a great institution with a lot of commitment. Yet she would not be leaving the career track. McGregor said she would like to be considered. Besides Gutman and Hassler, John Hodes, Webster's third special assistant who stayed on as a superclerk, interviewed her at the FBI. 3 weeks later, Gutman called her to say the judge would like to see her for breakfast. McGregor attended the breakfast in the FBI's executive dining room hours after she learned she was pregnant with her first child. One of Webster's assistants had told her she was one of a number of attorneys being considered for the job, and that Webster still had others to interview. She had no idea Webster would offer her the job on the spot. Webster explained the purpose of the special assistants. They were to be outsiders who would take a fresh look at the Bureau's activities, a new set of eyes that would judge issues by the standards of the public and the community. As lawyers, Webster wanted them to measure proposals against guidelines and statutes. But he also wanted the assistants to look at the FBI like John Q. Public to see if things made sense. At the end of the breakfast, Webster looked at her and said, "Well, I think I'm ready to make this decision. I'd like you to come and work for me." McGregor had planned to inform Webster that she was pregnant before he offered her the job. Now that that was no longer possible, she wanted to tell him before she accepted. McGregor wanted to tell Webster in private so that he could quietly withdraw the offer if he chose to do so without any embarrassment. She was aware that Webster employed two assistants, and if she were on maternity leave, he would be left stranded. Not only would she be the first woman in the job, but McGregor would be pregnant in a sea of macho FBI agents. Several White House fellows who were women had worked for Webster, but they were not considered on the same level as his special assistants. But both Gutman and Hassler were at the breakfast, and McGregor said she would have to think about it. Webster was furious with his two assistants. He had understood that they would bring him only a candidate who wanted the job. He hated rejection, and after the breakfast he raked them over the coals for not doing their homework. When she got back to her office, McGregor called Gutman. "There is something I have to discuss personally with the judge," she said. "Well, what is it?" he asked. "Something personal," she said, cringing. Webster was on a flight to Atlanta. When he called back, McGregor was in a meeting of partners working on a federal criminal case. They did not know of her application to the FBI. "Nancy, the director of the FBI is calling," a secretary announced. The others at the table looked shocked. McGregor excused herself and took the call in another office. She explained the problem, and Webster took it in stride. "What a relief," he said. "I was afraid you were going to tell me that you were a drug addict. That would have caused a problem." At the FBI, McGregor had to change from being a lawyer who kept a pile of papers on her desk to someone who locked up all her papers at night in a safe. She visited the FBI's shooting range at Quantico, Virginia, and rode with the director to conferences. She would wander into the executive dining room and munch on the superb chocolate chip cookies made by Ray, the chef. When she found the dining room served Webster eggs and bacon or sausages every morning, she got the chief to vary the menu with healthier foods such as fruit and cereal. McGregor reviewed such sensitive matters as requests for wiretaps in counterintelligence cases and proposals to arrest spies. Webster wanted every question answered before he signed off on such matters, and if all the material had not been presented, she sent the memos back for more work. If something went wrong, she was often the first person to tell Webster. Her rapport with him was so good that FBI executives joked that if they wanted to break any bad news to the director, they would do it either through her or with her present. On the other hand, even though Webster had been using them ever since he came to the FBI, some of the more seasoned FBI executives questioned Webster's use of assistants. They had spent their careers building enough trust so they would be allowed to see the most sensitive secrets in the government. Now young lawyers with no experience in FBI work were being allowed to see even more than they were. Philip Parker, the deputy assistant FBI director for operations in the counterintelligence division, was one of the FBI executives who came to call the assistants munchkins. It was not that he questioned their loyalty or trustworthiness. It was just that he found the thought of entrusting so much to inexperienced people unnerving. On the other hand, James E. Nolan, who preceded Parker in the same job, saw no problem with them. It gave him a sounding board when he thought maybe the career people were stacking the deck on him. He could get somebody else to look at it, Nolan said. When Webster moved to the CIA, McGregor went with him. By then, Hassler had been replaced by Mark E. Matthews, a magna cum laude graduate of Harvard College. McGregor's son Ben had just been born. McGregor took the required polygraph test at CIA headquarters. Since she was still nursing at the time, she had to leave the baby with a relative who lived near the compound so she could race back in time to feed him. McGregor regarded the CIA with a healthy skepticism. In part because of turf battles, FBI agents often derided the CIA in private. They questioned its competence and its adherence to the law. She came to the new job with similar questions. In turn, CIA officials treated McGregor and the other assistants with suspicion. She was the only woman among the top 20 CIA officials and aides who met with Webster every Tuesday morning. Early on, at one of the Tuesday meetings, Bill Baker turned to her and cracked, "You could be the answer to one of those 'what's wrong with this picture' shows." The assistants did not know the difference between an agent and an officer. Yet in some cases it seemed to operations officers that the assistants felt they knew more than the officers did about intelligence. For the assistants, extracting information was like pulling teeth. "When we first came to the agency, it was clear that we would have to fight for our jobs," McGregor recalled. "So many of the employees were just unwilling to share information with anyone other than the director, and I'm not sure at the beginning they were always willing to share with the director. They are so used to compartmenting everything. We often got the impression that we had to ask precisely the right question to get the information we were looking for. But they were not going to help find the right one. That sort of attitude makes you uncertain whether you have ever gotten the whole story." John Bellinger, who replaced McGregor as an assistant at the CIA, sensed alarm bells going off every time he called someone in the Directorate of Operations. Usually a higher-level official called him back with the answer to his question, rather than the person he had called. The assistants found they had to fight to get parking near the building and to be allowed to eat in the executive dining room, a prime perquisite. The food was prepared by graduates of the Culinary Institute of America. When members of Congress or heads of foreign intelligence services came to dine, Webster would joke that the CIA ran the dining room. The chefs served salmon fillet with béarnaise sauce and pork chops with caramelized apples and angel hair pasta for just $4 to $5.50. To the people around Webster, it seemed they had been tossed into a sea of Casey lovers. By its very nature, the CIA seemed less hospitable than the FBI, which was populated by garrulous agents. McGregor found the CIA types to be more intellectual, more book-smart than FBI agents, who tended to be down-to-earth, unaffected people. "I found the CIA people reticent and not very easy to socialize with," McGregor said. "There were few people who opened up. That's probably due to their training and the nature of the spy business. My guess is we were extremely unpopular, coming in as we did with the director and immediately having access to people and information that took others years to acquire. We bent over backwards to blend in, though, not to interject our personalities." When Webster first came to the CIA, he visited each of the agencies in the intelligence community. Often he took McGregor along. During a briefing at the Defense Intelligence Agency, a military man looked her over, looked at Webster, and said, "Judge, you got a real pretty one here." Webster stared back at him and said icily, "Yes, and she's smart as a whip." McGregor could tell Webster was annoyed. McGregor was impressed by the way Webster handled it. It was McGregor's mission to set up a system so that the paper that flowed to Webster was written in a format with which he was comfortable. It seemed to her that the quality of the internal paperwork was not as polished as that of the FBI. While the CIA did a magnificent job at writing reports and estimates for the policymakers, the agency was not used to writing papers and reports as logically and clearly for internal use. Moreover, everything was presented in jargon and acronyms. The special assistants could not figure them out. As a lawyer, Webster wanted everything presented in a clear, coherent, and cohesive way. McGregor began sending papers back with requests for more information, more clarity, and fewer acronyms. "At first I found it a somewhat confusing place," said Broomer, who had been Webster's assistant at the FBI and later became his chief counsel at the CIA. "There are a number of things that agency officers, particularly operations officers, view as second nature. Living cover, compartmentation, the inscrutability. The notion of not talking to reporters and wondering why reporters quote things that give the Soviets a leg up." Despite the problems, McGregor was uncomfortable with only one covert action proposal that came before the CARG committee. It seemed to her that the proposed action was a little risky, but it appeared the CIA was adhering strictly to the Constitution and the law. As John Hodes, Webster's superclerk, would observe, many of the decisions at the CIA required a theologian rather than a lawyer, particularly when it came to the question of assassinations. Assassinations had long been banned, but not everyone was sure why. "I never understood why bombing innocent people is more morally permissible than the assassination of a single one," said Thomas Polgar, a former CIA station chief, citing such situations as the bombing of Iraq. But what if a group supported by the CIA decides to assassinate someone? Does that mean the CIA has violated the executive order? If so, the CIA would probably have to withdraw its support from dozens of groups around the world. At Webster's request, the Justice Department issued a legal opinion that said that under existing executive orders, the CIA is not precluded from supporting people who engage in violence that leads to the killing of a foreign leader, so long as the CIA does not support the plans and is not aware of them. In practice, the CIA warns such groups that it will not condone assassination and will cut off support if one occurs. Still, because of compartmentation, McGregor did not feel she had a handle on what the entire agency was doing. Even though she was cleared for nearly every top-secret program in the agency, getting information out of CIA officials remained extremely difficult. The problem was not so much the higher-level officials who understood that Webster needed accurate information. Rather, it tended to be the lower-level case officers who gave her a hard time. The Directorate of Operations is like a wild animal in the woods, a senior lawyer in the agency told John Bellinger. You have to stand stock still and let them sniff you all over before they come to accept you, he confided. Slowly, the DO came to accept the assistants. I found them all doing their best to get along, said Claire George, who was deputy director for operations when Webster took over. I think they did the best they could. If operations officers were taciturn, they also did not understand the need for taking disciplinary action against those who had violated the trust the agency placed in them. After Webster disciplined officers for not telling the truth to the Inspector General and the Tower Commission about the agency's involvement in the Iran-Contra scandal, an aide to Claire George visited McGregor in her office at the end of the director's suite of offices on the seventh floor of the old building. The aide sat down on McGregor's couch and gave her a stricken look. This is the worst day in the history of the DO, Directorate of Operations, the man said. McGregor was unsympathetic. It seemed to her that the officer's thinking was myopic. As he saw it, it was an outrage for the DCI to take action against operations officers. It was demoralizing and devastating to the troops of the clandestine service. I can't believe that you see this as affecting just the DO, she said. Look at how some of the actions of the DO have affected the image of the whole agency. The agency is being dragged through the mud by Congress and the media and the administration. It is taking the fall for the whole fiasco. To McGregor, the encounter illustrated the extent to which some CIA officials felt loyalty foremost to their own directorate, rather than to the agency as a whole. McGregor also could not understand the criticism she sometimes heard in the building that Webster was anxious to please Congress and the public. That is exactly the way it should be, she thought. The agency can be responsive to Congress without sacrificing its mission. McGregor did not need to fight a lot of battles. She could find the information she needed one way or another. Only rarely did she bother Webster with one of her own problems. He had enough to do, she felt. Often people came to her with problems that they hoped she would pass along to the director. Seldom did she do so. Webster wanted his assistants to be his eyes and ears, as he put it, but it was not her job to be a conduit for anything she was told. However, if she felt the complaint was legitimate, she passed it along to Webster or to Gates, then deputy director for Central Intelligence. It was a constant balancing act between acting as a facilitator and acting as an independent analyst. McGregor had a hand in resurrecting moribund plans to build a daycare center for children of agency employees. The idea had originated with Harry E. Fitzwater, a deputy director for administration under Casey. However, without some word that it was important to the director, the plans had been pushed aside. McGregor brought it up with Webster at one of his breakfast meetings with his assistants. He said to go ahead. The Langley Children's Center opened in its own 10,000-square-foot building in the fall of 1989, with 104 children enrolled. One of McGregor's more fascinating projects entailed reading top-secret reports of cases that both the CIA and FBI had been involved in and had screwed up. For example, the CIA had provoked Edward Lee Howard into spying for the Soviets by firing him on the spot. Then the FBI fumbled by letting him slip past bureau agents watching him in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Reading the reports, McGregor saw how each agency justified its own actions. Webster did not maintain an open-door policy, but certain aides and officials could walk in at will. The Deputy Director of Central Intelligence, the Deputy Directors for Operations and Intelligence, the General Counsel, the Director of Public Affairs, Webster's assistants, and Webster's secretary. The deputy director had a door that opened directly into Webster's office. Webster was not used to dealing with a deputy who had as much authority as the deputy does at the CIA. He felt somewhat uncomfortable with the ability of the DDCI to walk in at any moment. It had never bothered him enough to do anything about it. Webster kept six wooden boxes on his desk and on the credenza behind it. Each was marked with a red plastic label. One was marked Critical Action for matters that required his immediate attention. On top of the box rested a black folder that contained personal papers, such as party invitations. He received 2 to 3 of these a day. Another box was marked Signature/Approval, for letters and formal rulings or rule changes that required his approval. Another said DCI reading for miscellaneous articles and trip reports. Webster had a fourth box for material relating to the management and coordination of the intelligence community. A fifth box contained briefing papers and biographical sketches of people he would be seeing at coming meetings. The sixth box contained intelligence estimates and other memos from the Directorate of Intelligence. In all, some 200 to 300 of these documents came in from the DI each week. Despite all the organization, McGregor and the other assistants sometimes left documents requiring immediate action on top of Webster's desk or on his chair to make sure he saw them immediately. Each day, at least 150 items came in for his attention. Because Webster realized his attorney assistants would not be as familiar with the work of the CIA as they were with the FBI's, Webster appointed an intelligence analyst as his executive assistant to read all the material and keep track of it. If Webster wanted to know the status of an issue, he could turn to the assistant, Paul Piller, for the answer. The assistants had access to anything on Webster's desk and could sit in on almost any meeting. They knew as much about what was going on in the agency as practically anyone. Occasionally, on matters that were extremely sensitive, the DDO walked into Webster's office and told him privately of a development. At other times, the DDO asked the assistants to leave at the end of a meeting so he could talk with Webster alone. The assistants made their recommendations on blue notepaper. Even though they carefully reviewed each proposal, Webster insisted on going over them. The assistants were always amazed at how Webster zoomed in on questions they had not addressed. He seemed to have a sixth sense for detecting areas that might prove troublesome. Just as if he were a judge on the case, after reviewing the recommendation of his assistants, Webster spent 8 hours reviewing the case of the purloined stamps within the Office of Security. This case is important to every employee in the agency because it gives a clearer picture of what is expected of us, Webster said in a statement distributed internally. Public service is a special trust. It is not easy. It is not without temptations. In conversation, the assistants found that if they mentioned another document, Webster would invariably ask why he had not seen it. They learned not to refer to other papers unless they had submitted them to him first. When the assistants made mistakes, Webster could become just as angry at them as at CIA officials. During the Iran-Contra hearings, one of the assistants prepared briefing papers that, because of an editing error, contained a sentence that was incorrect. Webster fixed his steely eyes on the man. He told him the work was not acceptable. To the others present, it seemed Webster was embarrassing the man beyond what was necessary. As a rule, Webster did not socialize with the assistants. They might be invited for his annual Christmas party at his home, or he might chat with them at a social function they had been invited to anyway, but Webster generally kept them separate from his social life. Assistants found that Webster was formal and businesslike at the office, but was warm and expansive at home. One evening at 10, Bellinger decided he would have to call Webster at home with a problem. Bellinger was amazed at how warmly Webster greeted him. Apologetically, he explained why he needed to call at that hour. Webster made it a point to tell Bellinger he had done the right thing in calling. In May 1988, roughly 2 years after she had begun working for Webster, McGregor left the CIA to move to Texas, where her husband, Neil Mann, a former chief of staff to Senator Arlen Specter, had joined a Houston law firm. Despite all the frustrations she had felt, McGregor came away with respect for the CIA and its people. They had an important mission, they worked incredibly long hours, and they were smart and highly competent. After leaving the agency, McGregor picked up the New York Times on her doorstep. It was then that the realization hit her. This is it, McGregor thought to herself. No more President's Daily Brief. No more inside information on pending terrorist threats. There will be no way to judge if an article is true or not. This is all I'm going to know. Chapter 24. X-Rated Chowder. After George Bush became president and asked Webster to continue as Director of Central Intelligence, rumors began to appear in the press that Webster was about to be replaced. The press reports said Bush only wanted him as an interim DCI until he could get his own man. Sometimes the reports referred to indifferent work habits. Later in his 4-year term, the press reports referred to his inexperience in foreign affairs or to the fact that he was not part of Bush's policymaking team during the Persian Gulf War. Usually, the reports were attributed to unnamed White House sources. CIA officials, so good at finding out secrets in other countries, never learned the source of the leaks while Webster was in office. While some White House officials were dissatisfied with Webster, most of the claims that appeared in the press were myths. After coming to Washington, Webster had quickly grasped the fact that Washington work and social life are intertwined. The best way to avoid being crushed by others envious of one's power was to keep a high profile on the social circuit and on the tennis courts. "I have made more real friends in tennis than I have at cocktail parties," Webster told the Washington Post. "It's much nicer to get to know people on a tennis court than it is in a hearing room." Webster played tennis with the likes of Mike Wallace, Merv Griffin, Zsa Zsa Gabor, Jack Nelson, the Washington bureau chief of the Los Angeles Times, William French Smith when he was Attorney General, columnist Carl Rowan, Senator Lloyd Benson, and Bush when he was Vice President. While at the FBI, Webster typically played tennis for an hour 2 or 3 times a week and on Saturday mornings, usually at St. Albans Tennis Club in Washington. It was less time than most people spend going to health clubs before or after work. At the CIA, Webster had to cut back to Saturday and occasionally Wednesday morning games. Typically, he was at the White House by 8 a.m. to brief the president. He left the agency at 6:30 p.m. In the evening, he attended social functions that were often related to the business of the agency. He occasionally came in on Saturdays and kept in touch from home, where he had a safe so he could read classified reports. Peggy Devine, Webster's executive secretary, usually came into work when Webster did. Each year she put in for 400 hours of overtime, the equivalent of more than 2 extra months of work. In fact, Webster's hours were not that different from Casey's. Bill Casey was there by 7:45 a.m., and he would leave between 6 and 7:30 p.m., then go off to 1 or 2 things in the evening and read in bed for 1 or 2 hours, said Herbert Meyer, his former special assistant. He was there on Saturday until lunch. Then he would play golf. Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens III played tennis 3 to 4 times a week, and no one complained. Likewise, independent counsel Lawrence E. Walsh, the special prosecutor, rarely came into the office before 10 a.m., yet nothing appeared in the press about his hours. In part, the inconsistent treatment arose from the inherently imperfect way the press operates. In most cases, the media rely on tips and leaks for stories. If no one is motivated to create an issue, a story may never appear. On the other hand, a critical story may appear simply because a reporter happened to meet at a cocktail party someone who felt that night like making a disparaging remark about his boss. In Webster's case, the complaints that he was an absentee director flowed from Webster's style, which was to weigh decisions carefully and, if possible, to obtain consensus within the CIA. Sometimes it took him weeks or months to sign off on a proposal, leading impatient subordinates to question whether he was asleep at the switch, particularly in his first years at the CIA. "He is not the sort of person to say, 'I've been watching you from afar and I have 47 things for you to do,'" Rumor said. Casey did that. Webster's approach was to wait and make sure he understood the organization first. "He is trying to find a way to find a solution that he can then both support and defend in a way that makes everyone say, 'I understand, although I may not agree.' He does his decision-making based on the principles. It's a very judicial style. Gather information. Keep an open mind. Think about it. Identify a framework for making a decision. Then decide," Rumor said. After his wife died in 1984, Webster went through a period of mourning that affected his work. But during most of his tenure, most of those who worked with him saw a committed, involved manager. Not a workaholic, but someone who devoted much more than the normal 40 hours a week to the job. The week of October 28, 1990, chosen at random, was typical of Webster's schedule at the CIA, a combination of weekly scheduled meetings, special briefings, ceremonies, public relations events, and social events. On Monday, October 29th, Webster arrived at the CIA at 7:45 a.m. and received a briefing on the latest developments in Iraq. At 8:10 a.m., he had breakfast with former DCI Stansfield Turner. At 9:15 a.m., he talked with college deans who were visiting the agency as part of the CIA's efforts to expand its college recruitment program. At 10 a.m., Webster had his weekly meeting with Richard F. Stoltz, the deputy director for operations, and his 55-year-old deputy, Thomas A. Twetten, who later took Stoltz's place. At 11:20 a.m., Webster met with the CIA's chief of station in Bangkok and his division chief to receive an update on events in the area. Appointments of chief of station, or COS, are approved by the director. Whenever a chief of station is appointed or leaves his or her post, Webster would meet with him. At 12:10 p.m., Webster met with Richard Kerr, the deputy director for Central Intelligence. At 12:30, he had lunch with the college deans and with Joseph R. Detrani, the CIA's director of public affairs. At 3 p.m., Webster met with Theodore Price, then chief of the Counterintelligence Center. After reading briefing papers, Webster addressed visiting cartography professors at 5:30 p.m. At 5 after 6, he met again with Kerr, then left for a reception given by Nujet Kandemir, the Turkish ambassador, to celebrate Turkish National Day. Like most of the events Webster attended at night, this had a dual purpose. Turkey was a strong supporter of the U.S. effort to remove Iraq from Kuwait, and both the CIA and the military had extensive dealings with the Turkish government. In the ensuing weeks, Webster would visit Turkey as well, flying in an Air Force C-141 Starlifter cargo plane, outfitted with special communications for his use. The morning after the reception, Webster met with Bush at 8 a.m. at the White House to give him his daily brief. At 8:40 a.m., he arrived at the CIA and had what is known as the executive breakfast. This is a staff meeting held every Tuesday with the deputy directors of the agency, their assistants, the heads of each office, and Webster's assistants. Roughly 20 people in all. Because of the need for compartmentation, nothing substantive was usually discussed. Instead, broader issues, such as the penetration of the American embassy in Moscow, might be on the agenda. On Wednesday, October 31st, Webster arrived at the White House at 8:15 a.m., where he briefed National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft and his then-deputy, Robert Gates. At 8:50 a.m., Webster briefed the president and arrived at the CIA at 10. When he met with representatives of Middle Eastern intelligence services. That evening, Webster attended a dinner at the Georgetown home of Catherine Graham, chairwoman of the Washington Post Company, to honor Per Gyllenhammar, who was retiring as chief executive officer of AB Volvo Gothenburg of Sweden. The next day at 1 p.m., Webster had his usual weekly luncheon meeting with Secretary of State James A. Baker III and his deputy Lawrence Eagleburger. At 4 p.m., Webster met with the intelligence community staff, a meeting he had every Thursday afternoon. This was followed by a meeting with Scowcroft and Gates. On Friday, November 2nd, Webster had his usual weekly breakfast at 7:50 a.m. with Secretary of Defense Richard B. Cheney and his deputies. At 11:20 a.m., Webster received a briefing on his forthcoming trip to Hungary and other East European countries. The following Monday, November 5th, Webster arrived at the CIA at 7:50 a.m. At 9 a.m., he had his regular Monday morning meeting with his special assistants. By then, Webster had decided to operate a leaner office. His own people were in charge, and he trusted the agency more. When John Hodes retired, Webster chose not to replace him. That left only his newest assistant, John B. Bellinger. Having started as a special assistant in 1988, Bellinger was the first one to work solely at the CIA. Because it took so long to master the intricacies of the CIA, Webster kept him 3 years rather than the usual two. Like the other assistants, Bellinger brought with him impressive credentials. He had graduated cum laude from Princeton University and become a Woodrow Wilson Fellow at the University of Virginia. He had then graduated cum laude from Harvard Law School, where he was an editor of Harvard International Law Journal. Besides attending meetings with the director, Bellinger worked on such items as covert action proposals, significant intelligence operations, defectors, inspector general reports and recommendations, significant legal decisions, security disapprovals, and congressional testimony and letters. Each year, some 20 people, including contractors, were fired as possible security risks in the intelligence community and appealed their dismissals to the DCI. In addition, one or two CIA employees were dismissed for security reasons each year. Bellinger reviewed these cases before Webster signed off on them. Webster's schedule was grueling, and he led an active social life as well. After the death of his first wife in 1984, Webster began dating Sally Tompkins, a National Park Service architectural historian. Tompkins had been to several FBI receptions, and Webster had noticed her. She was a family friend of Roger Young, who was then in charge of public and congressional affairs for the FBI. Young suggested her to Webster as a tennis partner. The two dated until Tompkins died of cancer at the age of 55 on November 27, 1989. Linda Jo Clugston played tennis, but dressed more conservatively than some of Webster's other dates. Webster first met her in December 1984 at a function for singles at the National Symphony Orchestra. Clugston is blonde and extremely attractive, with light blue eyes and a clear complexion. The daughter of a funeral home director, she had applied to the CIA but had been rejected because of a minor health problem. She entered the hotel sales business. "I wanted to go into undercover work, and that's how I got into hotels," she would say, and became director of sales at the Willard Hotel in Washington. Later, she was director of sales and marketing at the Watergate Hotel. A few weeks after they met, Webster called Clugston at her office at the Willard Hotel to ask her out. "They thought I was in some terrible trouble because the FBI was calling," Clugston said. "I was in the bathroom and my secretary was banging on the door saying, 'The FBI is calling. What have you done?'" In late 1986, Webster invited her to a dinner given by Count Wilhelm Wachtmeister, the Swedish ambassador in Washington, and his wife Ulla. After that, they began seeing each other off and on. Dating the DCI was difficult. When Clugston met Webster occasionally during out-of-town trips, she found the security detail consisted of three cars. Every time she entered his hotel room, even for something as innocent as meeting him for breakfast, alarms went off. "There was a guy sitting there, and every time you went in and out it would beep, and people would come running," she said. When they were in Boston, a cousin of Clugston's dropped off some New England clam chowder at the doorstep of the house she was staying in. As she was about to drive off, CIA security guards pulled their car up behind her and questioned her about the package she had left. Before they gave it to Webster, the security guards X-rayed it. At times, the security came in handy. Babs, Webster's basset hound, had a habit of running out the door of Webster's Bethesda home whenever the door was opened. The CIA men caught Babs and brought him back inside. The fact that the CIA usually drove Webster was a blessing as well. When Webster drove his own BMW, it often wound up in a body shop for a week. By 1990, Clugston had moved to Boston to take a job with the Four Seasons Hotel. But the relationship continued as Webster visited Clugston in Boston. Webster asked her to come back to Washington, and they both realized that marriage was likely. Webster told his children, William, Drusilla, and Catherine. On October 20, 1990, they were married in the Eisenhower Chapel of the National Presbyterian Center. Roberta Peters, a friend of the bride's, sang at the wedding. At the reception afterward in the Riverview Room of the Watergate Hotel overlooking the Potomac River, she sang Always a cappella. The 70 guests were limited to those the couple considered to be close friends or family, including FBI Director William S. Sessions and the two senators from Missouri, John C. Danforth and Christopher Bond. The only work-related guests were Richard Stoltz, then Deputy Director for Operations, Richard Kerr, the Deputy Director of Central Intelligence, William Baker, who had been Director of Public Affairs, Roger Young, the former FBI Public Affairs Director, Robert Gates, then in the White House, and Russell Brummer, the former Webster Special Assistant and CIA General Counsel. Clugston, never married before, was 34. Webster was 66. Even after remarrying, Webster kept a photo of his late wife Drusilla in his office at the CIA. 10 days after the wedding, President Bush and his wife Barbara attended a dinner in honor of Webster's marriage to Clugston. It was given in Georgetown by Betty Beale, a former gossip columnist, and her husband, George Graber. The other guests at the dinner were Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor and her husband, John, Anthony Ackland, the British ambassador, and his wife, Jennifer, James W. Symington, a former Missouri congressman who was U.S. Chief of Protocol, and his wife, Sylvia. And William K. Fritz, a Washington real estate developer, and his wife, Buffy. Beale had urged Webster to marry Linda. "What are you waiting for? You're going to lose her," she would say. Despite the CIA's success during the Gulf War and the support Webster received from Bush, press reports continued that Bush wanted the DCI out. Usually, the reports said the president wanted to replace Webster with James R. Lilly, who was about to leave his post as ambassador to the People's Republic of China. Unlike Casey, Webster was not a foreign policy junkie, nor did he want to be part of the policy-making team. He had taken the job on the specific condition that he would not have cabinet status. When he was with Bush, the two spoke in sentence fragments as if in code, leading some to wonder if Webster could speak English. Yet Webster was a master at public speaking, and his assistants never failed to admire his crisp writing. While foreign affairs did not come easily to him, Webster worked hard at mastering its complexities. He asked the right questions and digested all the facts. But he was a lawyer, not a foreign affairs expert. There was no way he could ever approach the facility of a Robert Gates in analyzing and commenting on world affairs. The director of Central Intelligence did not have to be an expert in each of the disciplines under his command. No one could have the background in intelligence, science, political science, and the dozens of other specialties that the CIA makes use of. Webster's style was to manage by eliciting the opinions of the experts and making sure those opinions got to the right people. But to many of those around Bush, that was not good enough. People such as Brent Scowcroft, the president's assistant for national security affairs, wanted a foreign affairs guru like himself in the job. Eventually, since Webster could not remain in office forever, the stories of his departure would have to prove correct, and so they did, 4 years after he became DCI. Webster had always wanted to return to the practice of law. At the age of 67, time was running out to get a lucrative offer from a law firm. With the Gulf War over and increasing pressure from the oversight committees to alter the structure of the intelligence community, Webster felt it would be a good time to leave. Moreover, having just remarried, he wanted time for fun. "He hasn't taken a 2-week vacation in 20 years," Linda Webster said, more than 4 months before Webster announced that he was retiring. "My guess is Bill will at some point say enough. You get bored with a job. He's been doing it 4 years. I'd get bored after 4 years. He wants to be able to take time off and play. We haven't been able to have a honeymoon. I think the point will come where he says, 'I want to take a weekend off and go somewhere and not have 9 security men trundling around,'" she said. "He's not 22. You calculate the number of years he has to play. He has earned it." If anything, according to those close to him, the repeated reports that he would leave the agency had only strengthened his determination to stay. On May 8, 1991, Bush called a press conference to announce that Webster had decided to retire. Bush said the decision was Webster's, and he said Webster had done a superb job, providing impartial intelligence rather than trying to shape policy. Calling U.S. intelligence during the Gulf War outstanding, the president said the intelligence community had performed fantastically. "I hate to see him go," the president said. "We had in the person of Judge Webster a former federal judge who was a strong and deep believer in the rule of law, who, as director, complied not only with the letter of the law, but with the spirit of the law as well," said Representative Anthony C. Bilenson, a Los Angeles Democrat who formerly was chairman of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. "After our experience with Director Casey, he was just what the doctor ordered." Under Webster, I would say the biggest change was bringing the clandestine service, along with the rest of the agency, toward recognizing the reality of congressional oversight and instilling a positive attitude toward working with the congressional side, in terms of being forthcoming in answers and being cooperative, Robert Gates said. "I think the rest of the agency was already there by 1987, when Webster took over. Casey's attitude, I think, communicated itself to the clandestine service more. Virtually every dispute was in the clandestine service. I think Bill Webster has made the clandestine service catch up. He has also been forward-looking by responding to new threats with the Counterintelligence Center, the Counter-Narcotics Center, and some capabilities that reflect better ways of dealing with old issues," Gates said. In an outdoor ceremony on July 1st, Kerr, his deputy, presented Webster with the Distinguished Intelligence Medal. Motioning to several of Webster's former assistants in the audience, Kerr said, "We don't take very well to outsiders, but Judge Webster chose his assistants judiciously." By then, employees had grown to like Webster. The rumors that he was not on top of things had vanished. President Bush nominated Robert Gates, the former deputy director of the agency under William Casey, to succeed Webster, touching off a major debate about Gates's knowledge, or lack thereof, about the Iran-Contra affair. Webster had planned to leave by the end of July, but as the debate about Gates's qualifications intensified, Bush asked him to stay on until the end of August, giving the lie to press reports that Webster had been pushed out. On July 25, 1991, Bush invited Webster, his family, and a small coterie of intelligence community officials to a cocktail party at the White House. Referring to Webster as a true patriot who performed in an outstanding manner during the Gulf War, Bush presented him with the National Security Medal and the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest civil award given by the U.S. government. Bush had previously awarded the medal to General Colin Powell, General Norman Schwarzkopf, Secretary of State James Baker, and Defense Secretary Richard Cheney, in appreciation for their efforts during the Persian Gulf War. By September 1991, Webster had become a partner with Milbank, Tweed, Hadley, and McCloy in Washington. Webster had served 4 years, longer than all but three of the DCIs, Alan Dulles, Richard Helms, and William Casey. During that time, he had restored to the CIA credibility, its most important asset. It is always difficult to predict how much of a CIA director's contribution will remain with the agency. Certainly, the counter-narcotics and counterintelligence centers will remain, along with the more formal and stringent procedures for approving covert action proposals. Because it was so overdue, Webster's change in policy toward dealing with the press can be expected to continue as well.